We are continuing our conversation, so your phone calls are still okay for David Coates, who joins us next. He's chair in Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University. He was born in the United Kingdom, educated at the universities of York and Oxford, came to Wake Forest in 99. He was at the University of Leeds in Contemporary Political Economy and Manchester in Labor Studies. He's written extensively on United Kingdom labor politics, contemporary political economy, and U.S. public policy. And he is our guest the second half of All Things Political. He is author of Answering Back, Liberal Responses to Conservative Arguments. David Coates, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. It's very good to be with you.
Yeah. Nice to have you on the air. Let's start with you as the same place we started with John, and that's the fairly dismal, again, report on jobs that came out just last Friday, actually, showing very, very, very modest increase and still this persistently high unemployment rate. I've been asking this for a long time now, but what is it that needs to happen politically in this country so that people who are unemployed or underemployed can have better lives?
Well, I think we do need to make job creation priority number one. I was listening to the end of your conversation with your other guests, and I do profoundly disagree. I think aggregate demand is the crucial variable on which we have to work right now. I mean, we seem as a political system to be preoccupied with the scale of federal debt, when in fact what we should be focusing our attention on is the scale of our international debt and the scale of our personal debt. And the way to get the federal debt down is to get economic growth going again by active policies, industrial policies that will generate jobs directly. And we need that as a top priority. So, and without it, in fact, this stagnant economy will continue to run its course for, it could be a decade, even two. We could lose a generation if we don't fundamentally change our public policy and do it soon.
But we don't seem to be taking any movement at all toward that, David.
Well, we have an extraordinarily dysfunctional political system in Washington right now. I mean, I think the Obama administration came in with all our high hopes around it. It didn't actually come in with an effective governing coalition. It spent a long time, as you know, handling Blue Dog Democrats and a very entrenched Republican minority prepared to play procedural games to slow it down. And since the midterm election in 2010, of course, it's faced a House of Representatives it doesn't any way control. So we are at a moment when we need, desperately need, strong federal leadership, but we have a political system that's designed to block it. Mm-hmm. And until we resolve that, I think we are going to be stuck.
And how do we resolve that?
Well, we resolve it, I think, several ways. It makes the 2012 election, as I'm sure everybody listening understands very well, absolutely critical. I mean, one way it could be resolved is by a complete sweep by the Republican Party so that they would take the Senate, hold on to the House, and take the White House. And then we would get into a period of extreme Reaganite economics, which will, to my mind, deepen our economic woes considerably and certainly turns into a significantly less attractive society for people who are not very rich. The alternative, I think, is to work extraordinarily hard to recapture the House so that the driving force for a more progressive economic policy can be reestablished, and to push the White House to abandon its preoccupation with bipartisanship when bridging the unbridgeable is literally impossible. I mean, I was very pleased to see the president getting a little punchier in the last month and calling the Republicans out, but I think we've wasted a lot of political capital pursuing these reactionary Republican politicians to the great cost of economic recovery.
A lot of analysts have had problems recently trying to understand what the president's philosophy is. When you say he is punchier in the last month, is that from his deep-seated conviction that we're actually seeing what he thinks about things now? Or is the criticism about him that he's pretty much tied into the people who have guided economic policy in this country for a long time and he's not likely to change his advisors or his path?
Well, I think he came in the middle, as in fact Democratic presidents tend to come in, at a time of very deep economic difficulties. So his freedom of maneuver was considerably constrained. In retrospect, he could have seized that moment more dramatically than he did. But at the time, I think people were so aware of how vital it was to keep the financial system afloat that he was cut a certain degree of slack by his own supporters. He is, I think, by temperament, more a centrist than a progressive. But he leads a political party in which there's a very strong progressive voice, and I think that's the one that he has to be increasingly pushed to listen to.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Elizabeth Warren?
I think she walks on water, like everybody else. I mean, Elizabeth Warren for president, please. One of your earlier people who called in talked about the need for public intellectuals on the left, and we have so few of them. But she's a wonderful embodiment of all the things that we would love to see in Washington. She speaks out exactly as she should, and she fights for the middle class, which is exactly what we need. No, I think we need, if we could clone her, I think maybe 300 or 400 of those would be just wonderful, actually.
She's getting
knows the secret.
A lot of attention from the liberal press. Have you been following that race pretty closely? I know we're looking at poll numbers already and whether or not her message is catching on. How closely are you watching that race?
No, I'm here in the deep south, you know, so I just assume that people up in the north are doing better than we are. So I haven't been following it very closely. There seems to be some relationship between progressive politics and low temperatures, and we're a bit too warm, I think, here
Carolinas. But we're in Wisconsin, so I'm not sure that bears out. It gets pretty cold in the winter here, sir. I was really shocked to read, I think it was in the Times over the weekend, the number of school teachers, it's over 300,000 teachers in this country who have been laid off. And it seems to me as though that's a rather striking number, that many teachers have been laid off. As we talk about trying to compete in the world and educate our students better, the result of that is larger classroom sizes. It's not getting exercise so that you're able to have your mind clear when you're working on your academics. What does that figure mean to you? What's going on with that?
Well, it means total idiocy to me, I think, it represents a failure, including a failure at the White House, to frame the issue properly. We've had about 8 or 9 months, haven't we? Thank goodness for the Wall Street occupation that it's shifted off the top of the agenda for the moment, at least. We've had 8 or 9 months of people saying that the big problem is federal spending, as though the number and the money were a crucial factor rather than what the issue, the things on which the money is spent. And so much of the TARP money, its impact was greatest, protecting state budgets that have to balance, and in the process protecting the jobs of teachers and law enforcement officers and firefighters and so on which we all collectively depend. Now, the president's been pushing for an active industrial policy and trying to regenerate our competitive position in the world. But at the same time, he's actually presiding over a politics which is eroding our investment in human capital. So apart from the loss of jobs for highly skilled and underpaid public servants, which is what we're actually talking about, there's also the long-term damage being done to this particular generation. It is absolute idiocy. And looking at it from outside, I'm sure most of our competitors just cannot understand the capacity of this political system to continue to shoot us in the foot.
Mm. Mm. Let's go to phone calls. We start with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Part of what I have to say is in reference to what the previous guest said, but it also has relevance here. I think the American public is becoming radicalized on both sides. I mean, to the point where sometimes extreme right and extreme left elements are finding common ground. It is because the Republicans are clueless and the Democrats are spineless. And President Obama has spent all this time trying to be bipartisan, trying to be conciliatory and cooperative, and he's gotten absolutely nothing for his effort. And it's taken him this long to figure out that he's going to get nothing for his effort.
David.
Yes, I mean, I think the thing that strikes me, Bill, is actually the anger that's out there in parts of the electorate. Maybe this is just being in the South, but I took my car out the other day with my Obama and my pro-union stickers on the back and got myself a very rude note stuck to my windscreen, something that must have been taken about 10 minutes to write.
Really?
And I do think, oh, yes. And so I think people are just playing mad, and they buy into this Tea Party stuff, and therefore, you know, those of us trying to argue on the contrary, the Tea Party solution is a disaster, actually find ourselves personally vilified. So I think, actually, there is a level of radicalization, but what worries me is that the level of radicalization on the right is of a particularly anti-democratic kind. There are moments of overlap, I think, on issues like trade policy, where sections of the right and sections of the left recognize that free trade is not a sensible strategy to pursue, and new trade agreements need to be binned. But in general, I think the antipathy to liberals and progressives among sections of the right, you know, continually heated up by Fox News and so on, is really terrifying.
We welcome more phone calls momentarily. Our guest this half hour is David Coates. He's chair in Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University, author of Answering Back, Liberal Responses to Conservative Arguments. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we continue our conversation. I want to tell you, tomorrow at 10 o'clock, Michael Lewis will be with us to look at, he just went everywhere where economies are just falling apart, starting with Iceland. The first chapter is on Iceland, and what a country that place is. And he went to Greece and to Ireland, and the book is getting a lot of attention, Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. He will be with us. And we're starting our pledge drive tomorrow, too. We're doing this half the time pledge drive, which is terrific for listeners and for those of us who are doing the interviews here. It starts tomorrow, so it's up to you as to whether or not we can make this something that we'll repeat. If you can pledge, don't wait till the pledge drive, do it now, and all the better. And what you do is go to WPR.org. David Coates, All Things Political is what we're talking about now. We're talking about All Things Political now. He is chair in Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University, author of Answering Back, Liberal Responses to Conservative Arguments. Ken in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, yeah, go Brewers. Yeah, I agree with that.
Go Brewers. We can agree on that. I'm with you, Ken.
Yes, yes, right away. My comment is that we've been fed this line. In fact, Paul Ryan over the weekend was claiming that the demonstrations on Wall Street and everything are being politicized and that they're showing fear and they're trying to drive fear into the voters. And it's kind of like ironic that he's coming up with this, considering that the Republican Party has used fear as a way to get elected multiple times. But my comment is that we keep hearing this, we need to continue tax breaks for the 1% and for the job creators. And we've been hearing this since Bush was elected and that these things went into place. And statistically, we've been losing jobs ever since these tax breaks have been put in place and jobs have been leaving at an unbelievable pace, going everywhere but here. So I'm trying to figure out why even conservatives, which I consider myself to be, continue to fall and agree and accept the fact that if we continue giving breaks to the rich, it's all going to help us in the end because that's what's good for America. It really isn't. The middle class is what's good for America.
Okay, David.
Well, Ken, it's very nice to meet a conservative on a program like this. How wonderful. Look, I think there are two narratives going on, aren't there, in contemporary American politics, one that the previous speaker actually drew on, the one that stretches back to Ronald Reagan and says, you know, Americans are by some kind of genetic code tax cutters and believers in individual freedom and no government regulation. And the other story, which narrative which runs back to FDR and beyond, back to Lincoln, which argues on the contrary that the state plays a crucial role in supporting a genuine freedom of people by giving them the capacity to live their freedoms in a positive, not just a negative way. And what has happened over the last 30 years is that the Reagan narrative has come to prevail, to the point at which, of course, the Reagan that they describe and the actual Reagan in practice are not entirely the same. So I think what we've got to do, part of what we've got to do, is to say to it, and say loud and long, that there is another American story, there is another America, and that the other America has much the better chance of generating wealth and prosperity for all of us. And I just don't hear that being said too often and too loudly by enough people.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, your deeper thoughts about now into its fourth week, the Occupy Wall Street? What is that saying, the number of people who are gathering there? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, it's very welcome, I have to tell you that. It amazes me how much poverty, how much inequality, how much injustice, how much house loss and so on people put up with without actually marching and demonstrating and protesting. So it's very good to feel that power again, and to see the way in which it just changed the public discussion back towards what are the real problems in this economy, which are the problems of uncontrolled financial sector and massive income inequality that's getting worse and robbing the middle class of the capacity to reproduce the American dream for its children. So in that sense, it's all good. I mean, the fear, I suppose, that all of us have is, whereas the Tea Party kind of naturally flows into the Republican Party, so much of the antipathy on Wall Street will also stretch out to take in the Obama administration. I mean, what we don't, I think, want to see, I want to hear what other people think, is a situation in which we have a one-term president because the base is so disappointed by the scale of his achievements. What we need to do is to keep him in and Perry or Romney out, but put the pressure on them the second term to be more radical than in the first.
And do you have faith, really, that he would have a second administration that would be what you just described?
Well, on its own, I absolutely believe not, no. But I mean, I think if we can get the House back again, I think there's a driver of this thing, then yes, I think there's at least some hope. I mean, presidents only ever do two or three major things. Our political system makes it so difficult to get anything substantial done. And I mean, he did get the health care reform. He did get the Dodd-Frank's bills through. They're both extremely defective from a progressive point of view, but they're certainly better being there than not. So I think there's a chance that if we get him back in and we keep the pressure on him, maybe things will go our way. But certainly if we don't, it'll go the other way. And that is really terrifying, I think.
Thanks.
So it's the defensive politics we have to play. And defensive politics are very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Ken, thanks. Ray in River Falls. Hi.
Good morning. Kathleen, I want to thank you and your people for giving us some programs of substance every week so we can talk about important issues. I really appreciate the work you guys do.
Thanks, Ray.
It's really important. With respect to, I think that the 99%ers should recruit Elizabeth Warren. I think she'd be a formidable candidate, a woman, a progressive, a consumer advocate. I think rather than going back to another 4 years of Barack Obama, she should consider a run. But I want to talk about Social Security and the idea that always comes up is raise the retirement age rather than maybe raising the ceiling that we tax at. You know, we've got a lot of hardworking people who, pour cement and make steel and build houses, and they're pretty beat up by the time they get to 65 years old. You know, people, I'm an accountant myself. I sit on my butt and earn a living like the guys in Wall Street or, you know, some folks sit in a chair and talk on the radio. We don't get so beat up from our work like those folks do. So I think they've got to be considered in the equation.
Good
when we
point.
Look at reforming Social Security.
I agree entirely. I mean, and I think if we're being absolutely blunt about this, Social Security is not in difficulty. I mean, it's an entirely funded system, and deals were struck with the previous generation that now have to be honored. So if you start raising the retirement age, you start eroding an agreement that's been in place for a long time. And certainly just to take the cap off would put enough money in the system to keep it viable well into the 2070s and 80s and beyond. So I think actually what we're seeing here again is an ideological assault really on state provision. What the Republican Party in particular is desperate to do is to get this thing into private hands because it absolutely believes that the public provision is not desirable. And the trouble with Social Security is in the public sphere is it works. It works really well and people like it. So Republicans don't take to that very kindly. And to see Democrats tacking to that particular argument is deeply disappointing.
Wouldn't it be hard, though, considering the history and how it was sold in this country to take the cap off Social Security?
Well, I think the cap has been adjusted before. I had to go back and look at the detail of the 83 settlement. But I think, you know, it was under Reagan with a Democratic Congress that the thing was reconfigured to ensure that its financial viability would stretch well into the 21st century. If it's been done once, it can be done again. But actually, you know, it's not the major player here. I mean, there clearly are health cost issues, which the Republicans refuse to allow a public option to drag down. And it's health care, which is the thing we ought to be talking about as a costly dimension of our future spending programs. And, of course, it's the cost of empire. Well, so long as we keep maintaining vast armies and putting them abroad, then the financial reserves available for social welfare and infrastructure development are going to be limited. I mean, I think the thing we need to be talking about on the left is a complete reconfiguration of the American model, including a retreat from empire. And the only people actually talking about that dimension of it at the minute seem to be libertarians in the Republican camp, where they get, even from Republican audiences, rather a large round of applause. So I think there are plenty of things we could be talking about, and Social Security ought not to be one of them.
Thanks, Ray, for your call. Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Well, just echoing the guest's very last point, The peace movement in Milwaukee had a event marking the 10th anniversary of the Afghan War. On Saturday, we had a speak out at the City Hall, quite a few people, a number of returned vets, a West Point graduate. It was a very diverse group. But there was a group of Ron Paul folks, and they were very much welcomed, and one of them got up and spoke and said that the only anti-war candidate running is Ron Paul, and I have to say that sounds accurate.
Yes, I agree. And I think, you know, it's a very, this, if you think about it, these all these 140, 160 bases we have worldwide have all been put in place since the 1940s. This is not a long-term American relationship with the rest of the world. It's one that's came into play in the Second World War and then was sustained during the Cold War. And in the post-Cold War period, needs to be very radically re-examined. And until the Democratic Party does that, it's going to have this huge Pentagon budget draining away the resources for more progressive social spending.
Thank you, Art. Chester in Athens, Wisconsin. Hi, Chester.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment is about the monopoly of where the majority of people in our area, I live in central Wisconsin, where they get their political news. It's a sad, sad day when Fox dominates our local radio station, every news station from our locals, and then, of course, the sick Fox and Friends type programming all day and night where you have to be a blonde to get these people to watch. Fox has twice as many viewers. Now, it wouldn't be bad if, in comparison to MSNBC and CNN, but it wouldn't be bad if they were halfway fair and balanced. But right now, for example, they're going after Fast and Furious, giving the absolute one-sided view. If your guest could give me a response to my...
Okay, your concerns. Thank you, Chester.
Yeah, let me say that. I mean, it, clearly, we are facing a hugely funded ideological onslaught from the right, and the mass media play a critical role in that. The fairness doctrine has been abandoned. The actual budgeting for it was actually cut by Obama quietly in the last round of shared cuts. So we have a media that actually is stacked against us. What is striking, though, is how little that penetrates. It does penetrate, but there's a huge amount of decent American opinion out there that doesn't buy the Fox line. And I think that if we were subject to the same coherence on the left as we get from the right, then Fox News would actually lose a good deal of its potency. And that's where I think the criticism of Obama has to be most sharply focused. He's got the bully pulpit. Every day he is there. For far too long, he's been saying that federal spending is like family spending and has to be balanced, which it doesn't. And for far too long, he's been trying to lean across the aisle to people who are not prepared to take his hand. He's got a year to try and undo some of the damage which that has done. And my own personal hope is that he can do that, not for his benefit, but for our protection. And the more public intellectuals, national and local, that we can generate to put the counter-arguments out, the better.
Mm. And who are the public? We got into a conversation about public intellectuals, as you know, the last half hour. Who are the public intellectuals that you pay attention to now?
Well,
than yourself, of course.
Myself, of course. Well, actually, I mean, we do have our own website, www.davidcoates.net, where we do try and keep these things up to date. But the major intellectuals are few and far between. E.J. Dion is one, I think, I would add to the list. I mean, so you get that from the Washington Post. You get Howard Mayerson also. But in fact, Krugman's, Stiglitz are the two, I think. Paul Krugman does a particularly good job in very difficult circumstances. What's striking is how few there are, except on MSNBC, where sometimes the level of subtlety is less than the left requires. But I'm personally very taken with the quality of Rachel Maddow's journalism. I think she's a very important voice. And of course, we have we have Jon Stewart and we have Stephen Colbert. So we do have, you know, some forces that we can exploit. But I think with the comedy people, they're very good at debunking what the right is saying. But we need to also be able to put the coherent alternative arguments into that space. And that's, I think, what some of the minor figures, which I would count myself, have a role to do, just putting that stuff, making it available to people so that they can quickly put the counter-argument with the same force, having seen Colbert and Stewart, you know, ram a big hole in the Republican wall.
David, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
David Coates, chair in Anglo-American Studies at Wake Forest University, author Answering Back, Liberal Responses to Conservative Arguments. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing and Chrissy Pease for producing. And thanks to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee Go Brewers studios. Tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour, Michael Lewis with some related issues as we look at the economy. Boomerang is his latest book, Travels in the New Third World. Taylor Branch joining us the next hour of our program this Monday morning. Thanks for your calls and listening.